So that's Numbers 16, verse 41 as the starting point on page 148. Hear the word of the Lord with me. Verse 41. But on the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Lord." And when the congregation had assembled against Moses and against Aaron, they turned toward the tent of meeting, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. And Moses and Aaron came to the front of the tent of meeting, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Get away from the midst of this congregation, that I may consume them in a moment." And they fell on their faces. And Moses said to Aaron, "Take your censer and put fire on it from off the altar, and lay incense on it, and carry it quickly to the congregation, and make atonement for them, for wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun." So Aaron took it, as Moses said, and ran into the midst of the assembly. And behold, the plague had already begun among the people. And he put on the incense and made atonement for the people. And he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stopped. Now those who died in the plague were 14,700, besides those who died in the affair of Korah. And Aaron returned to Moses at the entrance of the tent of meeting when the plague was stopped. Chapter 17, verse 1. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, and get from them staffs, one for each father's house, from all their chiefs, according to their father's houses, 12 staffs. Write each man's name on his staff, and write Aaron's name on the staff of Levi. For there shall be one staff for the head of each father's house. Then you shall deposit them in the tent of meeting before the testimony where I meet with you. And the staff of the man whom I choose shall sprout. Thus I will make to cease from me the grumblings of the people of Israel, which they grumble against you." Moses spoke to the people of Israel, and all the chiefs gave him staffs, one for each chief, according to their father's houses, 12 staffs, and the staff of Aaron was among their staffs. And Moses deposited the staffs before the Lord in the tent of the testimony. On the next day, Moses went into the tent of the testimony, and behold, the staff of Aaron for the house of Levi had sprouted, and put forth buds, and produced blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds. Then Moses brought out all the staffs from before the Lord to all the people of Israel. And they looked, and each man took his staff. And the Lord said to Moses, "Put back the staff of Aaron before the testimony to be kept as a sign for the rebels, that you may make an end of their grumblings against me, lest they die." Thus did Moses, as the Lord commanded him. So he did. And the people of Israel said to Moses, "Behold, we perish, we are undone, we are all undone. Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord shall die. Are we all to perish?" This is the word of the Lord, and you may be seated. I want to say a big thank you to Pastor Joshua and our musicians. Man, it's just so excellent week after week as you lead us to reflect on these truths. So many of them a preview of what's coming up in the sermon itself, and I know Pastor Joshua plans it that way. Thanks especially also to our prelude this morning. I just love Be Thou My Vision. For some reason, it was not in the rotation, the repertoire of my home church growing up. Maybe you guys kind of know what I mean when I say the repertoire, the songs that are sung, you know, and it was just not in there, and I did not hear that song until I was 19 years old as a college student. And I heard it and loved it instantly, and 3 years later, we had it in our wedding when Caroline and I got married. And so thank you guys for playing that one this morning. A word of housekeeping also as we begin. My family and I will be on vacation Monday through Thursday of this week, and so I'll be out of the office and away from phone and email, and so I'll try my best to catch up on all of that when I get back on Friday. I want to say a word of thanks also to Caleb Flores, who's going to be preaching next Sunday, since this week will be more or less a week off for me. And then, as just a preview of coming attractions, starting in May, we're going to pause our series through the book of Numbers. We'll get to the end of one of these rebellion cycles, and we'll press pause, and we'll do some summer work in the book of Psalms again. We did that last summer. We're going to pick back up on that again this summer, and then probably in late summer, we'll get right back to Numbers and hit the ground running. So that's a preview of where we're headed. All right, now a story as we sort of ease our way into this text. Shortly before 7 p.m. on March 2nd of this year, Philip Vasto made the call. And he pretty much had to. Vasto, who is from Brooklyn, was hiking through Arizona's Humphreys Trail, which is overlooking Flagstaff. He had made it more than 80% of the way to the summit, which is the state's highest point, when he sadly found himself lost. With snow obscuring the trail and wind whipping fiercely, Vasto realized that he had underestimated what an Arizona winter can do. I might have underestimated Arizona winter too. And so he did the sensible thing and called the Coconino County Sheriff's Office to say that he was indeed lost and in need of rescue. Fortunately for Vasto, there was a ski resort down mountain from him, which dispatched some tracked vehicles to find him and to bring him back to safety. Now, for many of us, if that happened, that would signal the end of our hiking attempts on that mountain. We would thank our rescuers, we would tip our cap to the mountain, and we would say, "You won." But not Philip Vasto. No, the very next day, he was back at it again. Quote, "I was thinking if I start early in the morning, I'll have all the time in the world to reach the summit," he said. And so, not content to leave well enough alone, he set out to conquer 5.5 miles of steep, rocky terrain. At about 5 p.m. that next day, guess whose phone rang again? It was the sheriff's office. And it was Vasto on the other line, who this time had sadly fallen off of a ridge and injured himself. Another hiker, Philip Wyatt, had stopped to help him. It was, quote, "very apparent that he wasn't prepared for the climate that he had gotten himself into," Wyatt said. Fortunately for Vasto, however, in Arizona, they'll rescue you on consecutive days. And so a helicopter was dispatched, and it brought the two Phillips down safely. Quote, "I really respect Phil's perseverance," Wyatt said. "I hope he's able to make it to the top sometime." The sheriff's office was less enthused about a third attempt. And in a public statement, it's always bad when they issue you a public statement about you. In a public statement, the sheriff's office said that it had provided Vasto, quote, with preventative search and rescue education about these winter trail conditions, and also, love this part, encouraged him not to attempt the hike again. Don't try it. I guess we'll see if the lesson sticks. Now, we're starting to get a similar feel in the book of Numbers about the nation of Israel. They cannot seem to manage to learn their lesson. They just can't get it through their head. They will rebel against God, suffer terrible consequences, and then basically hurry out the door early the next morning to do it all over again. And that's exactly what we find them doing in our text today. It's really the counterpart to the text we looked at last week in the beginning of chapter 16, where you have the rebellion of Korah and Dathan and Abiram. And it follows a pattern that you saw last week. Rebellion, judgment, intercession, and then finally a sign to remember. So it follows that exact pattern again. But this time what I'm calling this rebellion is an even worse rebellion than the last one. Now, I know if you're here last week or you know that story, the earth opened up, people were burned with fire coming from the tabernacle, you're saying that was pretty bad. And I'm claiming that this is a worse one. And the reason I'm claiming it's worse is because now the rebels aren't just these three guys, these ringleaders and their families, and maybe even 250 other people they round up, but the rebels are the entire nation of Israel. Like the whole of them, all of them, who somehow, defying all good judgment, have decided to side with the guys that the earth just swallowed up, right? You might remember from last week that one of the main complaints that the late Korah had was that he and the rest of the Levites should get to do what Aaron did as high priest. "We're all holy," Korah claimed. "We should all be authorized to offer incense at the tabernacle. We should all be able to function as priests. What's so special about Aaron, after all?" Well, as our text today is going to say, there is something special about Aaron. He's the guy, ironically enough for the rebels, whose intercession is the key to stopping the plague that's killing Israelites. So, guess he is pretty special. And, as chapter 17 will say, he's the guy whose rod will turn into basically a miniature almond tree all of this rich symbolism that carries. And so, teasing you a little bit there. More on that in just a moment. But it turns out, bottom line, that God's high priest is pretty important. Much better for Israel to seek him for the blessings that he mediates than to turn a hard heart and rebel against him. And if that was true of the first high priest, of Aaron, how much truer, friends, is it of the great and final high priest, the Lord Jesus Christ, the one that Aaron himself prefigured? Now, we could choose to rebel against Jesus. We could today repeat Aaron's mistake, or Israel's mistake, rather. We could say that Jesus is not so special after all, and that we want to go through life relating to God in our own self-appointed way. I'll make the rules here, God, we could say. But look at all the dead bodies and think again. Much better is it to trust and follow Jesus, the effective mediator who has come, right, to stop the plague of God's wrath upon his people, and who has in fact come to put our lives in bloom with a springtime of God's blessings. Much better to be loyal to Jesus. That's the exhortation I want you to consider today, and then we'll close today by remembering the work of Jesus in the Lord's Supper. But to get there, we need to trek through this text in front of us, and I'd like to do it in three parts. First, verses 41 and 42, where we see the rebellion. 41 and 42. Second, verses 43 through 50, where we see judgment and intercession. And then third, chapter 17, just taking all of that together, a sign to remember. So rebellion, judgment and intercession, a sign to remember. Okay, ready? Let's go. Up first, verses 41 and 42, where we see yet another rebellion. Just want to begin with a moment of candor here. My expectations at this point in the narrative are pretty, pretty low for the nation of Israel, right? Even still, I wasn't prepared as a reader for all of this, right? Like even this can take your breath away, despite all we've seen since chapter 11. The earth has just opened up to swallow three rebels in their households. Fire has just emanated from the tabernacle to consume 250 more who are trying to play priest there. And now, well, let's just let our narrator take it from here in verse 41. But on the next day, all the congregation of the people of Israel grumbled against Moses and against Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of the Lord." I mean, this is one of these moments in the Bible where you just kind of want to like run your finger in your ear. Did I hear that right? Did I read that right? And yet, here it is. Three things especially are terrible to me about this. The first is the timing. The text says that this took place on the next day. Let's just remember what on the next day means. On the next day, the ground was still freshly disturbed from splitting open to swallow people alive and then closing back over them. Right? Like the earth was still disturbed from that. On the next day, the bodies of the charred dudes might not have even cooled all the way. And yet on the next day, the people of Israel are right back to grumbling against Moses and Aaron, the very thing that got the bodies charred and swallowed the day before. This is like next level spiritual amnesia going on. Israel can't even learn a lesson that sticks for 24 hours. That's the first terrible thing. Here's the second. Second is the way they blame Moses and Aaron. In the Hebrew, the "you" is emphatic. You have killed the people of the Lord. You imagine them pointing their fingers. You have done it, right? Moses and Aaron. I mean, really, right? Moses might have been a strong guy. He did not just rip the earth open and then close it back up. Aaron might have been good with handling fire. He did not just shoot it forth from the tabernacle with enough force to burn up 250 people. You know who did do those things and who's being left out of consideration here? Israel's God, the Lord, did. But notice this. Had they acknowledged God's role in the judgment, they would then therefore have to admit that what the rebels did and what they are so fond of doing in rebelling against Moses and Aaron is wrong and is worthy of judgment, and for them that is a bridge too far. And so they're just going to leave God out of the equation and blame Moses and Aaron. If Israel's been steadfast in anything to this point, it has been unwillingness to admit when they're wrong. That is just not part of the calculus for them. And so, Moses and Aaron, your fault it is. We're going to blame you and not ourselves. And then the third thing that seems particularly terrible to me about this is the way they identify the rebels who just died. They don't say you've killed the mutineers or the rebels or the ne'er-do-wells. They say you've killed the people of the Lord. So now you want to invoke the Lord, right? Not as righteous judge, but to identify him, as it were, with these rebels, to put those mutineers on his side in a manner of speaking. Now, I know that in one sense, all a person had to do to belong to the people of the Lord was to be born an Israelite, and if a male, received the covenant sign of circumcision, that made you kind of externally in covenant with God. But as the Apostle Paul points out in Romans 9, not all who are descended from Israel belong to Israel, which is a way of saying that they weren't part of his true spiritual people who were united to him from the heart. And so it strikes me as a bit of selective history here to refer to the rebels as the people of the Lord in a way undifferentiated from a faithful Israelite. Seems to me like Israel's probably trying to whitewash the rebels' reputation a bit. It was like a dishonest eulogy. You've been to those funerals before? Like, this bears no resemblance to the person I know? And so basically, in these three ways, Israel has now spectacularly allied themselves to the rebels rather than to God's chosen leaders. It doesn't get much worse than this. It doesn't get much worse. But then in verse 42, we get this ominous note, ominous for the rebels at least. And when the congregation had assembled against Moses and against Aaron, they turned toward the tent of meeting, drum roll here, and behold, the cloud covered it, and the glory of the Lord appeared. Now, if you've been reading through the book of Numbers, you might pick up on this, you might not otherwise. What's happened in the book, the last two times the glory of the Lord appeared, is that his faithful and persecuted people have been defended. Think Joshua and Caleb in chapter 14. Think Moses and Aaron a moment ago in chapter 16. And the worst of their persecutors have wound up dead. Think about the 10 spies who didn't believe. Think about Korah and company. But here's the pregnant question that lands after verse 42. What do you do when the worst persecutors are actually now the entire nation? Right? What do you do with that? What then? Looks like Israel, like Philip Vasto, is going to need rescuing 2 days in a row. That brings us to our second section, verses 43 through 50, where we see what happens next. Judgment and intercession. Judgment and intercession. In verse 45, God tells Moses what's about to go down. Get away from the midst of this congregation, he says, that I may consume them in a moment. Now, that language may sound familiar to you. This is the third time in this chapter, chapter 16, that God has warned people to steer clear of the guilty when judgment comes raining down. But, so it's familiar in that way. But it may also sound familiar in a second way, which is that we've seen this larger pattern in the book of Numbers where God will announce to Moses in advance that he plans to destroy the nation of Israel. And earlier, starting in chapter 14, we made this observation about it. God is telling Moses what he intends to do rather than simply doing it and explaining it after the fact. And that is a really big difference to me. There's a world of difference between I'm about to consume them and here's what all these millions of dead bodies are doing, lying around, right? Post facto. And you might remember back in chapter 14, the significance we found in that, which is that I think by telling Moses first, God is in effect stirring him up to do the thing that God wanted him to do all along, which was to intercede for the nation so that God might spare the bulk of it, right? Isn't that profound? God wanted to spare his people from the worst possible outcome, so he uses his announcement of judgment to motivate the mediator to intercede for it. But actually, there is one discontinuity from the other times we've seen where Moses interceded. In chapter 14, and then more recently in chapter 16, verse 22, it was in fact Moses who interceded in prayer. But notice this time, it's Aaron who will offer the incense, which I think is symbolic of prayer in the Old Testament, and make atonement for Israel. So Aaron is involved now. And that seems fitting because his authority also has been under attack in this chapter. Let's pick up on the action now in verses 46 through 48. Moses said to Aaron, "Take your censer and put fire on it from off the altar and lay incense on it and carry it quickly to the congregation and make atonement for them, for wrath has gone out from the Lord. The plague has begun." So Aaron took it, as Moses said, and ran into the midst of the assembly. And behold, the plague had already begun among the people. And he put on the incense and made atonement for the people, and he stood between the dead and the living, and the plague was stopped. Wow. In my mind, that produces this super vivid image, right, of this whole scene unfolding. The plague, and we don't know exactly what sort it was apparently really malicious. It was wiping out people left and right as it made its way through the camp of Israel. And then here comes Aaron, sprinting as fast as his sandaled feet will take him, smoking censer in hand, to stand in between the living people and the spreading plague. Now, we just got to stop and say, that was incredibly risky for Aaron to do. The high priest, under no circumstance, was to be in contact with the dead, lest that defile him and preclude him from his work. But Aaron is willing to go, potential uncleanness notwithstanding, potential contagion of the plague notwithstanding. He's thinking not of himself, but of his people who need him, even the very ones who have insulted and defied him. And then he gets there, and it happens. Aaron skids to a halt, we imagine, and the death stops right where he stands. It goes no further. Aaron becomes the line of demarcation between life and death. His incense, symbolizing his prayers for God to avert his wrath, forms this wispy boundary between judgment and mercy. 14,700 perish, and deservedly so, but by his actions in that moment, more than 2 million are spared. Look at the effectiveness then of the high priest intercession. Earlier in the chapter, the illegitimate incense of the 250 people playing priest provoked God's wrath, but now the legitimate work of the one high priest turns it away and spares millions. Spares millions. All right, let's connect a few biblical theological dots at this point. What if I told you that there was another high priest who also formed the line of demarcation between life and death for his people? He also saw them coming under the judgment they deserved. He also ran to their aid when they needed it. He also brought himself near the realm of death to save them. In fact, he succumbed to it for their sake. And because this high priest has not only died, but now risen again and ever lives to make intercession for his people, not one of them shall ever be lost from the salvation he has earned. He is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 25. That great high priest, friends, that rescuer of rebels, is Jesus Christ, the one who fills full the pattern that we find here. Maybe this morning you are, in fact, a believer in him, but you've walked in conscience deeply wounded from your sin this past week. "I did it again," you say, with incredible remorse. Surely, for someone like me, the well of grace has run dry. Surely, what I stand to face is God and all of his terrifying wrath. Surely, if I'm being honest, my conduct deserves no less. But today, with the eye of faith, would you see Jesus, your high priest, standing in between you and the judgment you deserve, his blood shed for you as that line of demarcation? Without that, yes, wrath would have consumed you, but with that in place, and also with his daily intercession for you before the throne of grace, there is a sure and immovable barrier. And you are not on the side of death, but on the side of life. There is the answer to preach back to a wounded conscience: Jesus' own wounds and his ever-living prayers for you. See him standing there like Aaron, and see yourself safe, sheltered behind him. So far, we've seen Israel's rebellion. We've also seen God's judgment and Aaron's intercession, which ironically enough validates his very position that Korah had been trying to attack. But God has one more validation left. This one, an unmistakable sign to put to rest Israel's grumblings against Aaron once and for all. Let's look now at chapter 17 and see a sign to remember. If they had polled me on where to make a chapter division, I would have put one where we started our text, would have made that the beginning of chapter 17, lumped all this together, but you'll just have to see it following the pattern here and connect it in your mind. We see a sign to remember. What I'd like to do first is talk about the sign and the symbolism itself, and then finish by thinking about what a right and wrong response to it looks like. So the sign and symbolism first, and then the response second. All right, let's start out with the sign and symbolism. Chapter 17, God orders every tribal leader to write his name on his staff, his rod, and to give it to Moses, and that Aaron is also to do the same. And then, well, here's the clever thing. Here's the clever thing first. In Hebrew, the same word here that's translated staff can also be translated tribe. It can also carry that meaning. So God is doing something here, right? He hasn't just arbitrarily picked a staff. The staffs represent the tribes. You can see that symbolism, that connection. Moses is to collect these. He's to put them in the tabernacle before God's visible presence in the most holy place. And then the staff of the man whom I choose shall sprout. Sprout? You mean like things growing out of it as if it's alive, even though clearly it is just a dead stick? Yes, sprout. That's exactly the plan. That would be the test. It would be unquestionably supernatural. So then, whose rod would God choose? Whom would he pick to serve him at the tabernacle? The narrator doesn't keep us long in suspense. In verse 8, we read, "On the next day, Moses went into the tent of the testimony, and behold, the staff of Aaron for the house of Levi had sprouted and put forth buds and produced blossoms, and it bore ripe almonds." Whoa! I mean, the bar was just set at sprout, and I mean, that was high enough, right? We would have accepted a few little green shoots and said, it's all good. I mean, you made your point, God. But what he does here is greater still. There's sprouting, there's buds, there's blossoms, there are even ripe almonds. Could it be any clearer that God has chosen Aaron, right? This is like God's exclamation point here. Right? He has clearly chosen him. Aaron's staff has turned into this full-fledged almond tree, somehow undergoing multiple phases all at the same time. And in verse 9, Moses takes it and shows the tribal leaders, who are no doubt amazed and have really no retort to give to that. And then in verse 10, God tells him to hang on to this sign. He'll put it in the testimony, the Ark of the Covenant there, as this perpetual evidence to deter any rebels who might get the idea that Aaron is not so special. Aaron is the choice. Let it be noted, Israel, God is saying, for the sake of your lives. Now, that part of the symbolism, I think, is pretty obvious. That's surely the primary takeaway that Israel is to make right here. But I'm inclined to think that it was not the only takeaway that they were supposed to make from that budding rod. And here's why I say that. There was, in Israel's midst in those days, another symbolic almond tree. Right? This wasn't the only one. There was another one. And if you're racking your brain and wondering what it was, I'm going to go ahead and just tell you the answer. It was the golden lampstand inside the tabernacle. As Exodus 25 describes it, and you can go back and read this for yourself, it consisted of a main stem with three branches coming out on either side of that main stem, each ending in a cup that held oil for burning and was, I'm just going to quote this part, made like almond blossoms. Uh-huh. And decorating each branch and stem were a series of budding almond flowers. Whoa again. Now, coming back to Aaron in just a second, but first just track with me as we kind of lay some groundwork. As we observed back in chapter 8, the golden lampstand represented the light of God's shining face there in the tabernacle. In fact, Moses had been instructed to position it so that the lampstand gave light to what was in front of it, which was namely the 12 loaves of bread. If you're thinking, I know something else that existed in that number 12, it was the 12 tribes of Israel, then ding, 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 you're right. So the 12 loaves represent the 12 tribes, the lampstand represents God's shining face, and adding that all together, the picture God was arranging was of his shining face lifted up on Israel continuously. The Lord bless you and keep you, Aaron had prayed. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance to you and give you peace. And in that symbolic picture of lampstand and loaves, that's exactly what God was doing. That's exactly what he was doing. But now in chapter 17, I think we get sort of an addition to the picture. God is clarifying here exactly how he'll mediate that grace and blessing to his people. They can't go outside, or rather inside the tabernacle, to witness that whole scene for themselves, right? That's prevented for most Israelites, the rank and file. They can't go in and see it for themselves. So God here, in effect, is bringing the almond tree out to them in the person of his high priest who would represent God and his grace to the people. If you want to see what my gracious and shining face looks like, God is saying, you'll see it in my high priest. If you want to know what it looks like for me to keep you and watch over you, look no further than Aaron stopping the plague. If you want a window into my own heart, look at my interceding high priest pouring out prayers for you. It was a profound thing for God to teach his people. And in fact, a profound thing for him to say in that very moment. Grace to those people after back-to-back days of rebellion. And yet God is saying, this is what I'm like. Behold your God. Now, even though the world of Israel and its symbols seems quite remote to us today, I think it's still important for us to notice something as Christians, which is that God has not scrapped this basic structure of relating to people. His appointed high priest still does represent him to his people, still causes his face to shine upon them, still guards them and keeps them, still intercedes for them when they sin, still gives them his peace. Brothers and sisters, that is what our Lord Jesus is to us. And as Ian Duguid says so vividly, in Jesus, like in Aaron's rod, God's blessings are in bloom. In Jesus, spring is in the air. This is the sort of God he is to us. It's such an apt thing to think about as we're in the spring season right now. Jesus himself is this explosion of bloom, color, fruit, God's blessings, and he bestows those gifts on the lives of those who come to know him. Our lives begin to take on the beauty and the fragrance of God's blessings in them. Have you thought about that, Christian? That God wants to make your life burst into spring from the inside out. Left on our own, we only produce the dead of winter, no life, no flowers, no fragrance in us. But when we come to know God through Jesus, we come alive. Budding, sprouting, flowering, fruiting, our lives become a veritable spring. Isn't that beautiful? Have you seen this in your own life since you've come to know Jesus? Or perhaps if you don't know him today, does that entice you? And you say, I want to meet the man who can do this in my life. I want to meet this man and see. Talk to me afterwards. I'd love to tell you more. But that brings us to our response. And I guess in a way, this is me telling you more. Israel here makes the wrong one. They make the wrong one. In verses 12 and 13, they say about this great sign they've been given, behold, we perish. We are undone. We are all undone. Everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord, shall die. Are we all to perish? I read those verses like a pendulum swing in the completely opposite direction for them. Earlier, Israel has thought too highly of themselves and refused to acknowledge their rebellion. Now it seems they're seeing something of their condition as sinners and the danger that that represents dwelling with a holy God, but they are thinking too lowly of God's grace. They went from, I'm too good for grace, to I'm too bad for grace, which is really just another species of unbelief, isn't it? And tragically, Tragically here, they miss God's heart, which is not to keep his people far away from them, but to lead them out of their sin, to draw them near through atoning sacrifice, and to bring them into the richness of his blessings. God has just given them a double demonstration of that desire, that they experience life and beauty, life through Aaron's intercession, beauty through his flowering rod. But here stands Israel fearing death, the very opposite. They've missed God's heart in all of this. God hasn't made his dwelling there because he enjoys killing Israelites. He's moved into their midst to be gracious and shine the light of his face upon them. He hasn't come near because he wants to incinerate or to swallow alive or to devour with plague. He's come to set their lives into full bloom. But even though God has laid his heart open, as it were, for them to see here, Israel has tragically missed it. God's kindness has gone unrecognized. They see him only as a danger, not as a willing and warm savior. And so tragically, it remains winter in their hearts. But there is no reason this morning that you and I have to repeat that mistake. No good reason to do that. Instead, can't we just see God's heart revealed here, leading us to confess our sins, to trust in his son Jesus for forgiveness, and then to experience his blessings? Just because Israel stayed in its sin and its consequent dread of God doesn't mean that you and I have to. What if today instead we come to him right now for cleansing, and then we bask in the light of his presence as he intends it to be? What if we rejoice in his face lifted up on us in the person of his son Jesus? And bathed in that warmth, what if spring's flowers fill our hearts this morning?